168 for June 22nd, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here at the end of the climate crisis. Thank God the climate crisis is over, Pam.
Absolutely. I felt super positive when I finished this book.
We are reading How to Avoid a Climate Disaster by Bill Gates. It was published in 2021, that year that will go down in history. And
it's a pandemic, my friend. The pandemic will go down in history.
He does mention the pandemic at the end of this climate crisis book a little bit, just because of the timing of the publishing.
Exactly. I mean, he finished writing this book, what, in November of 2020? Mm-hmm. It's released in February of 2021, so earlier this year. So he's basically got the latest, I guess, science that deals with climate change. He's got what we're going to discuss today, sort of some policy types of things that he's suggesting based on his conversations with leading people on this. And then, you know, you got to follow it up with like, hey, we got a pandemic going on. Let's talk a little bit about that.
And not to mention the politics of November 2020. There was a lot of politics going on at that time, if you remember. Do you remember that?
Well, there's still those politics going on today. Oh, okay. Some people really haven't accepted what's really going on, Steve. Man, it gets a little ugly sometimes around the dinner table.
Yeah, so this is an extremely topical, timely book. There's no doubt about that. So as we've been kind of speculating, as we read the first three quarters of this book, Gates does actually bring us some policy discussions in these last three chapters. So I was just curious what you thought about these policy suggestions, which ones really stuck with you, which ones did you feel would work, which ones did you have questions about?
When I'm reading, I'm thinking too, constantly thinking. I think the major policy suggestion that I got out of this is this national grid, or this ability to get the grid. It could be statewide. Every state has their grid that must plug into the next grid. And I immediately thought, this is a Department of Defense initiative. Mm-hmm. This is not any different than when we set out and we put together a national highway system. And it was under the Department of Defense. And the reason being is, first of all, we're not going to get 50 states to agree. So and I shouldn't say 50 states. We need 48, the 48 states down here to agree. And so let's just say Virginia and North Carolina work nice together, but Indiana and Illinois say that there's different ways of dealing with things. Well, that's not going to work. In addition to that, as they start laying this stuff out, you could just imagine going over somebody's farm, somebody's building, somebody's town, or something like that. You're going to have the ability to violate rights, mm-hmm. And not have holdouts. Whew. And so there's going to be the real challenge. And if you're dealing with this on a state-by-state basis and not under something like defense, this will be held up forever. And it's just going to be more efficient to say, all right, this is what we have to have.
Says Mr. Hessenflow, the German heritage person.
Says yes. Mr. Hessenflow, who worked in Washington on the Hill.
Efficiency.
So, yes.
Efficiency and breaking certain people's rights. That's frightening when you say that.
It absolutely is. But it's not any different than when they built O'Hare. So O'Hare had horse farms around it. So people who are not familiar, O'Hare is one of the largest airports in the United States, right outside Chicago. And ORD. Orchard. It was an orchard. Mm-hmm. Horse farms are all around there. Well, at some point, some horse farmers didn't want to sell out.
Sure.
They were holding out. And this is a classic economic issue. And so there are no horse farms around O'Hare anymore. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, they have to figure out ways of working around that. And there are some really negative things they could do. They could condemn your property. They could tax the death out of it to get you out of there. Or they could just buy it out and, you know, send you on your way. There'll be something that'll end up having to be done. This will be a lot of contention on being able to do this. I don't see how it could be done on the level and that it can be done quickly enough without, you know, some kind of blanket area above it. And I'm just immediately thinking Department of Defense, because this is a defense issue. If you're on the South, we're still dealing. I was driving up yesterday from North Carolina to the Chicago area. I stopped at a gas station. They had the bags still over. The BP station I stopped at, they had no fuel.
Still?
Yes. Wow. So this is in West Virginia. Now, the next station did, so I don't know what happened. But that, I mean, that was over a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's definitely defense level. We need to make sure that we have the energy that we need. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, the idea of putting up nuclear power plants, you know, that's going to be something that we have to be conscious of.
And if we think about how the West tamed their natural resources, you know, basically taming rivers and redirecting those waters from Colorado down to California to the desert where they're growing food. This is that type of level of changing the environment for a modern world. So if we're going to have nuclear type of facilities rebuilt, you know, places like Nevada or the desert in Arizona, stuff like that, maybe better places. The desert in California, maybe better places to do that than, you know, next to cities and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so even if, as we're using modern thought on that, I mean, I couldn't help but think this is, we haven't seen, I mean, this is on the space race type of level. Yep. As far as ambition, but this is also back in the Great Depression type of level of changing. Huh. The environment.
You think the roaring 20s is going to be a thing, huh?
The roaring 20s?
No. Huh?
No.
Huh?
No. I didn't say that. I'm talking about after that, about how the Blue Ridge Parkway was built.
Okay.
How, you know, you're talking about the amount of people having to, you know, the question is, will Americans build this infrastructure, or are we going to have to continue to import people to build? Hmm. Because that's what farmers are running into the South. They're importing people to go pick those fields,
right?
Because Americans aren't willing to do it.
Wow.
So if we're going to build this type of stuff, you know, that's a lifetime worth of employment. That's a lifetime worth of benefits. Project. And stuff, yeah. Like that. And those are incredibly ambitious projects. So anyway, my initial thought when reading this is where my mind went, that this is incredibly ambitious. And it's going to be, this is going to be rechanging something that was a patch quilt to be much more efficient.
What do you think, Pam?
Well, I thought that one of the interesting pieces of this last portion of the book is that Gates really talks about the importance of government investing in research and development, but also in making regulations that kind of support those investments. And so I thought he made some very passionate pleas for things that governments can do. And, you know, kind of transparently, although he says it's important that all this happen at an international level, it's like he feels the US should really try to be a leader in this, which I completely agree with. And so he goes through these 7 high-level goals for governments. And my own personal feeling, and I'll be curious if you guys agreed or not, was that he has some terrific ideas here. I don't really think he spent enough time rebutting the counterarguments. So Chip, what you just said is unfortunately, like, I totally agree with that. Like this, if the states aren't all gonna agree, then it's kind of hard to do anything, especially the kind of big picture things he wants to accomplish. So if you guys don't mind, I'd love to go through those 7 high-level goals. This is very well organized. Like rhetorically, it's beautifully set up, but in my opinion, he didn't rebut the counterarguments as well as he needed to.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Yeah. He's okay. Coming from his perspective as somebody who not only is a CEO of Microsoft, former CEO, sorry, but also coming from it with this idea of he wants to build these nuclear plants. He wants to be at the forefront of this innovation.
Well, at least for the first part, I don't think he's spent enough time in local governments or yeah. State governments or county governments to see the lack of money that they have. Mm. And as a person sitting at the really table important. Who's got a trustee that is a partner, they'll immediately see that the budget goes to pensions or the budgets goes to you know, fixing the local water hole that is broken or whatever that thing is.
Yeah.
And there's just, they don't have the legal right to raise taxes. They don't have the legal right to, in fact, they'll be voted out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the other part is that no one's going to say, you know what, I'm willing to pay significantly more.
And he brings that up from his very rich perspective of we should be willing to pay more to fix this crisis.
Yeah, why don't you put that on your ballot? Like, hey, we need to pay the police pension more and have your population vote on that and see what they think.
Mm-hmm.
Because immediately he'll say, oh my goodness, that will never pass.
Agreed.
There's the real challenge, especially when you're dealing with extreme local governments. And that, I mean, I basically shotgunned what my thought was. The department, it has to be under a blanket area and it's got to be a much grander thing.
Central planning?
Well, it's going to be
is that what you're, is that what you're...
Defense is the one area in the Constitution that is given to the government.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you have the right to defend yourself, but as far as national defense, mm-hmm. that is the one area under the federal government that's given.
Yeah, I like that point a lot, Chip. And I feel like, so the very first high-level goal he has for government is to mind the investment gap. And by this, he means with green technologies, a lot of times the profits are not going to come quickly. So they won't necessarily, the R&D won't necessarily be happening in the private sector. So the government has to actually support research and development in green techs that will eventually be profitable, but they have to fill in the gap. And he gives really good examples. He's like, this is how we got the internet. This is how we've had tons of life-saving medications, GPS systems, things that have ended up being super profitable for private companies, but needed that government intervention.
So you can immediately see of Elon Musk
mm-hmm.
and his failed companies.
They're not failed yet.
Well, I mean, they keep getting folded into Tesla.
So they're not yet failed.
Well, they did fail because he had to fold them in. But my point being is Elon Musk is a great example of the amount of money yes. that was given to basically this man's vision certainly was incredible. So I you know, assuming they're on the level of Musk in the sense that they can at least spur the imagination of the public.
It's expensive. That's his point. His point is that this is a very expensive process and it's not going to be full of successes. It's going to be full of failures. And he talks about that specifically.
But I mean, on that same note, even though the solar panel company failed and was folded into Tesla, solar panels are all around us.
Solar panels are all around us. I love solar panels. You guys don't get that joke at all. That's fine. That's for a very, very small part of our audience. Solar panels.
Fair enough. Now, the second thing he says after minding the investment gap is leveling the playing field. Now, this is the one where I especially thought he needed to rebut some counter arguments. Personally, as a Canadian socialist, I completely agree with him. Of course, you need to level the playing field. You need to raise the cost of fossil fuels by incorporating the cost of carbon so that you are providing some incentive for people to create greener energy. And you have to make carbon emitting things more expensive. Now, Gates says he kind of tries to rebut the obvious counter argument. This isn't a punishment. It's just making carbon-free things less expensive by comparison. And he says we need a carbon tax.
And this is a tax of the poor.
Mm-hmm.
This is a tax of the poor. And this is where it really gets ugly because all of a sudden we've already seen it. $2 fuel becomes $4 fuel. Okay. And $4 fuel becomes $8 fuel. Who does that hit most? The poor.
Mm-hmm.
And those people will suffer under this team. And I think there's a real challenge there. And then try to go to Texas and make this argument. You know, try to go to North Dakota and make this argument. And there you're going to run into the real challenges is that their economies, a lot of it is these fossil fuels. And it's interesting. Texas certainly, if Texas could somehow follow California and leading research, if they could somehow come to terms with working with the California initiatives, they could basically just dominate the market, just basically change it. Say, okay, this is how we're going to do it. But Texas and California's thought patterns or leadership are going to fight this out. And that's why, once again, I think it's a Department of Defense initiative.
Yeah. So Chip, you're exactly making my point that he doesn't address any of that. He just says, we need to do this. And point three, right? So it ends up not being very persuasive because we all know that the resistance on that is so high.
And I think he might have benefited from having a co-author on this, because this is certainly very much, I am Bill Gates. I see this path because I have this perspective. I have this amount of money behind me, and I don't have that counter argument really boxed up well in here. I agree.
And then his third point is to overcome non-market barriers. And so he talks about, and this I think is an easy one. This one doesn't, to me, this wasn't even one of the big seven, but I don't know what you guys thought about that. He says there are lots of barriers other than economic ones. So sometimes people have a lack of information. In some parts of the country, there's a lack of suppliers of green technologies. Sometimes it's, you know, renters who really need to be making decisions and landlords just kind of let things ride, which is certainly true. But I guess these non-market barriers, things that don't have to do with cost, I'm personally not so worried about. I think he should have gone from point two straight to point five, which is plans for a just transition, which addresses what Chip was just saying. You need to have answers to the people and specifically the states that currently rely on fossil fuels and meat production if you're going to actually make those things far more expensive. The federal government has to have a plan. And he says you can help people. Let's just go back to Chip's example, the Texas, California. You can just provide funding to Texas, and you can connect people with similar challenges for information sharing. And I mean, I guess, I don't know that the problem people have is not enough information or not enough connections. I think it's a very deep economic model problem, personally.
I think it's just a different way of living. Like, right. Texas is all like, live free, we're independent, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But you're not getting my butt, but you're going to subsidize us. And I mean that because Texas is the most schizophrenic state out there. They feel like they are the special, you know, flower out there. Mm-hmm. And Texas does bring a lot to the world. But I mean, Texas and California thought in many ways dominates a lot of how we think. Well, I should say New York too. But it's just there's two just very different ways of looking at the United States. And you know, by the way, California is emptying out into Texas. Mm-hmm. So my point being is people are choosing to live in Texas and abandoning California. So this is another part of that. You can't just make money up out of, out of air. I'm sorry, the Federal Reserve can't. But anyway, I don't know what you do with this, this group in Texas that, they've built at one time. They've learned to pull, basically fuel from sand. Mm-hmm. And that is a Department of Defense type of thing too. And where these big, big housing areas used to import, oil and stuff like that to hold it. Now they're holding oil to be able to export it. So, there's a lot of challenges here.
It's very complex for sure. And that independent spirit, that American, we have to do this on our own, that independence is certainly a part of this conversation, where then the big but is those subsidies, the idea that we will do this on our own as long as we get the money to do this.
Well, and they'll find some workaround. There's the whole point also, is to work around, because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. This is where Texas really is going to have to be a part of the answer. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking of it strategically on until you can get the leadership on there. Because I'm thinking of, we have the cold snap earlier this year, and the wind farms in Texas stopped working because they didn't have the proper amount of whatever.
Whatever they needed to make the lubricant it happen in to temperature. Make it. Right.
And immediately the representative from Texas says, see, green technology doesn't work. Followed by the people in Antarctica saying, well, we're in Antarctica and ours are still working. You guys made choices. And so, I mean, there's a lot, and goes back to decisions that are made. And I'm sure the decision was made is we could spend, you know, X amount of dollars for this, or we can save money, X minus whatever that dollar amount is, if we don't have this technology part of it. Why would we have it? We're in Texas. It's not going to get that cold anyway. So it's, you know, that is the type of public relations disaster you don't want to have happen.
And that's part of point four is the stay up to date, making sure that we have all of the best information, staying up to date with what the climate is going to do as far as we believe, and trying to keep up with all of that technology.
Well, and there's a real challenge there too, because the technology you have today and 10 years from now are light years. And these things, typically, if you're going to build one, there's a shelf life. And we talk a little bit, it could be 25 years. Well, all of a sudden you've got old tech. Now, you can replace your laptop every 4 or 5 years. No big deal. Okay. But replacing significant, you know, the $25 million blah, blah, blah is much more challenging because it requires such a heavy investment up front.
Yep. The upkeep absolutely has to be figured into any investment.
And for any, if you think of any household too, and I'm going to use, going back, just regular appliances, an old refrigerator that you bought back in, I don't know, 1990 still works, right? Yeah. The current technology that we've got, because of cost, because of materials, because of demands, they go out in 5 years or whatever. So all of a sudden you've created a whole different challenge that you're dealing with. Automobiles are working very similarly. They just, because of the demands they're putting on them and how we're building them now, I don't know if they're, you know, is it planned obsolescence or is it dictated because the demands are so much greater on the materials? This is
going to be difficult. That was so there's paragraph number one in this book 4 weeks ago was this is going to be difficult for sure.
We don't do things because they're easy. We do things because they're hard.
But that's also point six under the, like, what do governments need to do? You have to do the hard stuff too. And to me, this is one of the super important points. Some stuff is easy. And even I love the examples he gives that are, like, not that easy, like wind, solar, electric cars.
If you're a billionaire.
How they're not super easy, but they're manageable. We do need to make a lot of progress with all of that, what he calls low-hanging fruit. But he says we also, at the exact same time, we have to also be focusing on the much longer term, much more difficult problems that are going to take enormous innovation for solution. That's like the focus on cement, steel, fertilizer, things that are far less within the individual control of consumers, but in the big picture, how do we feed the world? How do we make stuff? And
if only we had engineering schools. I mean, if only we had them. You know, maybe a school like Purdue or Texas A&M. But it comes down
to an agreement to do
Georgia Tech.
It's that agreement. It's not that individual thinking. It's the broader global thinking. That's where we have a hang up here.
On the global thinking?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of those innovations come in and then they're kind of brought out to other areas. I mean, so, you know, we do have them. I don't think Georgia Tech is touting their new cement innovations as much as the robotics group is jumping around with their latest stuff. Some of these things are going to be, you know, just quieter.
Cement, steel, and fertilizer, I agree, are kind of underneath the flashy, the things that a company could make money with, but at the same
time, they're not sexy.
There you go.
But yeah, but drought resistant crops. I mean, it's not like we don't have, you know, think about it. Every few years you get the new apple that comes out. Every few years you get the new grapefruit that comes out or whatever it is. And, you know, many of these are just These are research at schools. At one time, you know, tomatoes are the great example right now because, you know, they were terrible for so long. Yeah. When you make the tomato, it tastes better, but it's more fragile. You know, all right, now it's not as fragile, but it doesn't taste as good. Mm-hmm. So they're constantly kind of playing around with stuff. Well, you know, what else are you going to do in Nebraska or at University of Illinois or Iowa State or whatever? You're going to work on innovations.
And the cement part really comes to the forefront again in this section of the book where he's really talking about how somebody needs to do something about cement because cement is bigger than I knew about.
We need more Reardon steel.
Well, whatever. You know? Whatever.
And then Hoffa cement.
Oh, boy.
So there we go.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. That turned dark very quickly.
And no one got the Reardon steel one. I just want to make sure you got nobody got the Reardon steel.
Nobody.
There we go. We're just going to leave that one right there for the people who know.
And that's the segue to the seventh grade innovation. He says we need to work on technology, policy, and markets at the same time. And I think he's really right in noting that there's often a mismatch. There's these three levers. They have to be pulled at the same time and also heading in the same direction. So he gives a couple of negative examples where we have the technology for nuclear, but we don't have the right policies and we also don't have the right market incentives. He talks about biofuels in the same way. And, you know, I felt like that really reminded, as he was talking through the biofuels example, I was like, oh, I vaguely remember reading about that. He talks about solar as a really positive example of something where you did have policies that encouraged people to buy solar, which created market incentives and created additional supply. So, for example, the price of solar has dropped 90% since 2009. That's incredible. And as you were just saying, Steve, you see solar panels on people's roofs all the time now, whereas 10 years ago, it was a bit of a rare thing. So, you know, there are positive examples, but there are like big negatives too. So we have to try to get some match between policy and market. I think it's a super good point.
They're still early adopters. We're not really sure. A lot of these contracts that people are signed for the solar is questionable at times. But the point is that we do have early adopters on this. And I'm really surprised. There are neighborhoods going up all over the place. And with these new neighborhoods, because you know we need housing, why are they not becoming greener?
Where's that innovation? Where's that impetus? Where's the price match where those companies want to create those green houses?
I did stay in Richmond, Virginia a year and a half ago before COVID at a conference. And I stayed in Airbnb from a whole neighborhood that was downtown Richmond. And the whole neighborhood is basically solar. Mm-hmm. And I think the guy said he had to turn on his heat just a few days during the year. Mm-hmm. So what was the difference? He was able to buy his home. His home was a little more expensive because it had all the green tech in it, but that was all rolled into his mortgage. Mm-hmm. And so the point being is that his other utilities were very minimal because he was basically paying for it in his mortgage payment.
The hybrid automobiles, how many people are prepaying for the energy in those hybrid automobiles? The cost of that innovation is higher, but therefore their cost of using that vehicle is lower. That's the balance. Where is that sweet spot where people will turn to electric cars? Where is that sweet spot where people will put on solar panels?
Well, even on electric cars, I was thinking, you know, what about ripping up these roads downtown Chicago and basically running charging down the middle or the middle of your lane, mm-hmm. and basically having your car charge along the way?
How many billions of dollars are you talking about to make that happen?
Well, that's the type of thing that you know, a city should attempt. That would be a place that you could try.
Who's going to pay for it?
Well, that would be the black budget of the Department of Defense. Think about how much money the Department of Defense has. Some of those monies could be redirected.
I endorse you for Congress to make this happen.
Within the budget. I don't know. Did you guys ever read or see the movie Charlie Wilson's War?
No, you've talked about it, but I've still not seen it.
You need to see this. This is a Texas rep who basically, through his connections and solving the issues of the time, put together an off-book budget. And it was billions and billions of dollars solving little things here and there. And it was just, it was nuts. It was nuts. This is a non-budget allocated budget that was solving these things. Anyway, I should probably rewatch it to kind of get more details on it. But the whole point of the movie talks about this guy in this itty-bitty district basically creating this incredibly large budget that was off the books. It was off the books.
So I think one of the things that really struck me as a big point out of this, which very much relates to the conversation we're just having, is that reducing carbon by 2030, which is one of the goals that we hear all the time, and getting to zero by 2050 are not necessarily complementary. And this is something I've heard many times from my friends who do the climate policy, specifically at my university, that if you do the small stuff that gets you some reductions by 2030, you now just committed to like new steam pipes or new small things, that means there's zero chance that you're going to get to zero by 2050. So if you make an investment today in something that gets you partway there, that means you're not making the bigger investment in something that gets you all the way there. And so I just thought that Gates laid this out really well and clearly. I don't know that he has the answer, though, to we have enough money to do the small thing, but not enough money to do the big thing, which I think is like often the case.
Well, I think that he does a great job showing the confusion of the two. Mm-hmm. Because you can make a small adjustment in your home or your lifestyle or whatever it is. That's a temporary type thing. Now, your city or your county or your state could do something like that. And it costs a lot of money to do it, but it's not really solving what the big picture is. Mm-hmm. And so this is, once again, you can make incremental adjustments. Great, you're marginally better. But to get to the next level, it basically could be ripping up and starting over in a way. And that's where like the energy grid comes in. Like that. That's a bigger issue. And so, you know, it could be, once again, the state works on the 2030 type thing. And the I'm using the Department of Defense under mine, works on under the national type of thing. Because these are two... There are two separate issues going on.
It's so interesting to think of it that way, because we always think about it has to be incremental. We have to get to the next small piece in order to get to the major. But he's right.
I'm going to go back and try to make this a little easier. In your community, there are federal highways. Those are maintained by the federal government. Okay, there are state highways. They're maintained by the state. Then you have your local. Mm-hmm. So you have county and state. So they each are divided on how they're dealing with stuff. And so it could be where this is how it just needs to be addressed. You know, the state or the county or whatever can work on the marginal stuff, because these are things that you can deal with. You know, and maybe you deal with some national issues here and there. But on the grand scheme of things, the 2050 goal, that could be, once again,
central planning
under Department of Defense. Once again, recognize with where you've got, if it was just like Congress mandating, it's going to be held up. There's no way you're going to be able to get through, because Texas will fight you, and all of a sudden Florida will fight you, and then all of a sudden North Carolina will fight you, and you just get caught up in the courts. Mm-hmm. With the Department of Defense type initiative, this is how you're going to be able to shotgun through a lot of those issues. Yeah, I'm sorry your town's there, but we're blowing through it, and yeah, so be it.
I think of Chicago and how it benefited from the Great Chicago Fire when it all just burned down and they had to start over fresh. Some of these issues cannot be changed.
That is a terrible argument. Good God, Matt.
This is
Bassat's challenge with a person who threw and broke the glass in front of the bakery. And somehow they were like, well, that's a great thing because all the economic activity it provided. No, it took away economic activity. This is much grander than that. you have to think of it as a, I'm using defense, because we have to put it on an umbrella that says, this has to happen. This is part of how we are rebuilding the modern world. And this is like a 30-year, 40-year program. This is going to be a whole group of workers. This could be their entire career.
It's the Green New Deal, isn't it?
Isn't that
one of the points of the Green New Deal, was maybe the best thing to do would be to destroy some of these buildings that are less efficient and build new, more efficient buildings?
No deal was different.
Isn't that one of the points that the people against the Green New Deal were like, that's ridiculous. That is a ridiculous idea to knock down perfectly good buildings.
I think that when you start looking at national infrastructure, and like I said, it could be state by state and trying to figure out how to connect it. You got to figure out a way to create this different way. The highway system is the best way. How do you get military from one part of the country to another? Well, that's how they got it through. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that you're going to be able to get it through under a Green New Deal without having the right department leading it. Because mm-hmm. it'll get caught up in
as it has already.
Well, I'm showing you how mm-hmm. you get it through, because what happened in the South with the pipeline is a great example. All the hacking that's going on right now, that's going on with these companies. That's a Department of Defense that's moved it. This is not any different than the Navy keeping the seas free so that the goods can go back and forth between Europe and the United States, between Asia and the United States, between Africa and the United States. The Navy keeps the seas safe so those goods can go back and forth. The idea would be to create safety, you know, for electricity or any number of other things. Who knows? There'll be some winners in this, right? It could be areas that people don't want to live become the energy producing areas. It's where all the nuclear stuff is, which means once again, you're going to have bases around there to protect those areas. So once again, I think it just becomes a defense issue.
So it's interesting that in chapter 12, Gates provides us with a lot of analogies. He didn't go with the Chicago fire. However, he did go with some interesting ones that I thought we might want to talk through. So one of the things that I really enjoyed is when he noted that when he first started Microsoft, their goal seemed insane, a computer on every desk. And I often think how lucky it is that I was born in the early 70s, because it means I had a full life before there was a computer on every desk. I perfectly remember the days when there was not a computer on every desk. And I was personally a very late adopter. And so I don't have a computer on my desk until grad school. However, that's something that now we can't even really imagine our workplaces without a computer on every desk.
Typewriters. I have a typewriter in my computer lab and I show it to the kids and they're fascinated.
Tom Hanks collects typewriters.
Yeah.
But I really take that point that we have to be able to imagine a very transformed world, because otherwise we're not going to get it. So we have to be able to imagine this. And I think it's really important. It's one of the reasons that all of us love speculative fiction, right? Whether we're imagining nightmares or really fascinating and beautiful imaginary futures, we're doing that imaginative work. And I think that's really important. Now, he says that poor preparation for pandemics, because people have been saying pandemic's coming for a really long time. And mm-hmm. we know quite well that our preparation was not adequate. It should really encourage us to do better preparation for the climate crisis. And then without pausing on that point, he moves on to be like, look, guys, we can do awesome things. Look at the Human Genome Project. It's a great example. Governments around the world making really good investments, working together, having a great impact, not only on people's health, but also creating enormous profits from the various technologies that have come from the HGP. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. It feels to me like HGP is a great example of the things that are easy. And mm-hmm. pandemic's a great example of the things that are hard, because when you're preparing for a disaster and you don't know exactly when it's going to hit, it's super hard to sell the idea to the population globally that this is an investment that you have to make. So this is another place where I was like, love the analogies. Really think you needed to spend more time on the rebuttal. So I feel like I am super glad that we read this book, and I think I got a lot out of it, but I also am not like, oh good, innovators have it under control, I'm going to stop worrying about the climate crisis.
Well, it's very different running a company like Microsoft, mm-hmm. who's competing in a global market, yep. Than it is basically trying to shift preferences of the population. You know, we do have global shifts. I mean, as soon as a company like Apple brought out the iPhone, all of a sudden, all those little typewriter cell phones became like, oh, outdated. Mm-hmm. So immediately you get a new adoption. And so, you know, the idea that your home has, you know, X, and all of a sudden now we all have refrigerators. Well, how lovely for us. Mm-hmm. Where will the shift come where it'll just be like, oh, of course I need to do that. I'm going to do things the modern way.
And again, how much of that has to be incremental? How much of it can be incremental? Should we be investing in the 2030 idea, or should we be looking at the larger 2050 idea?
Of zero.
Zero. You know, that's for me, that's the complicated part. Mm-hmm. I put solar panels on my home. That's the incremental. I got the electric car. That's the incremental. Is that helping? Is that going toward the zero?
So I'm going to just explain it in a different way. You and I were sitting on the board of our local community, and we have new houses being built. And what are we going to do? We have to have streetlights. We have to have sewage and all this other stuff. Well, of course, we're going to put LEDs in. Even though LEDs are more expensive, we just know they last a long time, blah, 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 blah. All right, so that's 2030 thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So 2050 thinking would be, all right, so what can we get to glow that is not going to use anything? And so that's the difference in thought. The incremental stuff is stuff that we can do today that, you know, maybe you spend a little bit more on it and stuff like that. But really, it's our Band-Aid for the moment, mm-hmm. as opposed to rethinking how to design the area.
Right.
And, you know, if you think about the new communities going up, and I see them because I'm in Wake County, North Carolina, and they're building houses like crazy. And you recognize like, oh my God, I've got to walk 2 miles to get to the grocery store. Well, that's a design issue. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, why are they doing it that way? Well, because it's less expensive.
Right.
But that's not being thoughtful. That's not recognizing that all I've done is I've just created the same challenge for 2050 where I could try to solve that today. There's the disconnect on that. It's just a different way of trying to address some of those issues. We can deal with some of the stuff today that's just going to be a little bit of money, but really it's the bigger stuff is going to take a little more, it's going to be a little more challenging.
I really like that example, Chip. And I think this brings me to, I didn't write down very many actual quotes from this because this isn't like the kind of text where you're like, ooh, this is a great quote. But I did write down this one, which is, quote, "I hope you'll spend more time supporting whatever you're in favor of than opposing whatever you're against." And I kind of like that idea that there are so many different pieces to this puzzle and we need people working on all of them. And like, that's great. Like the LED example versus like finding something that glows without emitting anything. That's a great idea. And we need to be doing both of those things at once. And we need to like not be opposing. I really did like that a lot.
The millennials could be changing this because they are the voting block right now. So was this book, and there's a question to ask, was this book written for millennials? People younger than us, because these are the people buying the minivans that are electric. They are the ones buying the Teslas. They're the ones doing a lot of the innovating because their values are asking for that. Was this written for them? Knowing that, you know, there's a group of people that just could be a lost cause.
Are you calling Generation X a lost cause? Oh my goodness.
We're bitter. We will never live.
All of our listenership. Nobody listens to this show anymore because no millennials are listening to this show.
Well, on the grand part of it, though, you know, there are early adopters like Steve.
I am a Generation X early adopter.
Okay,
but I want that electric minivan so bad, and Volkswagen won't sell it to me for another 2 years.
Well, and boomers, there are people who are early adopters there, but there are also people who, you know, still like, you know, they like the clicker, Steve. They like to change the channel on the clicker.
So they need cable. They need $100 a month for cable because they like to change the channel. Yes.
Okay. So, and rightly so. I mean, that's the world that they know.
Mm-hmm. I get it.
Okay. So the idea of having extreme change may be so foreign to them, mm-hmm. and so disturbing to their way of life that they just have a very difficult time moving to a new way of doing things.
And thinking of the future needs to be the next generation. It needs to be the generation coming up that is the ones who are thinking of this for sure.
And here's the real rub on that.
Mm-hmm.
Think about who ran for president last year.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the younger generation?
No.
Or people who have a very short time on this earth?
Because the Andrew Yangs of the world, all of the young people, quote unquote, young people that ran for president were not the right candidate. Why was that? Because of the voting block? Because of the thinking? What was it? Uh-huh.
There you go.
Great question.
So there we go.
So Bill Gates does get to the end of this concept for us, and he does get to what you were expecting, Pam, a section where he lays out what we can do, what each of us can do.
He has both the big policies for governments, but then for individuals as well. And he has sort of two suggestions for individuals. First of all, we're all consumers, so we can make consumption choices, as we've talked about many times. But also, we can be voters or local politicians too. And so he suggests make calls, write letters, attend town halls. What you can help your leaders understand is that it's just as important for them to think about the long-term problem of climate change as it is for them to think about jobs or education or healthcare. So he's like, basically, pause to think before you buy stuff and get involved in politics. That's how you make a difference.
You can get involved all you want. The deal is you still have to have the votes. You got to have the voters. If you're the person that's most expensive and you're not making your case enough.
It's a balancing act for sure. It is a balance between the cost of doing this and the cost of not doing it. That's something that we've talked about for three books now. The cost of getting this done is going to be high, but the cost of not doing it is going to be higher. So that balance of explaining to everyone how important this is and how we need to work together and get the big central planning idea of it through the Department of Defense.
I know. You have to realize how to get it through. You can't get it through by the Department of Agriculture has mandated whatever.
Correct.
It's not going to work. It'll get caught up in, I'm telling you, it'll get caught up in.
I heard you.
All the crap.
I'm listening.
Yeah, man.
So I guess in summary, then, I'm really glad we read this book. What about you guys?
I am also glad that we read this book. I have new information that I did not have before, and that is the theme of my life and the theme of this show and the theme of all of my work is, what don't you know? You don't know what you don't know. Now I have new information to go forward to think about all of these issues.
So I leave this book in a similar spot that I began this book, recognizing how challenging it is to talk to the general population. And if you cannot come to them as this overeducated group that's like, this is the moral obligation, and stuff like that, you've got to be able to really articulate what we can do and how you can have an impact to society, mm-hmm. moral or not. And this group of people is still going to be the one. I mean, they're the people who are the anti-vaxxers. They're educated people that just don't have enough information. There is a group of people out there that's just, they're just going to fight you along the way on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very difficult, like I was driving through the wind farms in Indiana, and they're like, well, I'm not really sure if those are good for the environment or not. Well, at some point you got to test it out. And those things had to go up, and you got 1,000 of them out there. And what are they producing, and how is it working, and how does it work in snow, and how does it work in blazing hot summers? Okay, those types of things are tests. And if they work out real well, then maybe they move to other markets and stuff like that. So these are people who are just naturally skeptical anytime. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be able to communicate those. So this, what I would say from this, there's got to be more things. Maybe Bill Gates needs to have a program where, you know, he over a week, he basically explains the book out in television terms. And then there's got to be other ways of doing it. I think the university system is a system where, first of all, ideas are explored in general. So you do get a group of people who get to go in, assuming that they're not feeling like they're being indoctrinated and they're being enlightened, mm-hmm. then yay. Then you do have a group of educated people, but that's not the ones you're going to have a real challenge with. There's a whole group of people out there. They're just never going to go and experience it. And they're just going to deny the world exists because they can. And they're called, you know, people who can live wherever they need to. And they vote. You need to convince at least 10% of your population. 10% of your population can change any policy.
I like that idea of like going even more popular than this very easy and accessible book, going to something like a television program or like a web series or whatever. But I still think that like throughout all of these conversations, we've brought up things that have to be rebutted. Like I wouldn't necessarily, if I were going to say, yeah, this should be changed into other formats and spread more broadly, you have to address like the cybersecurity of all of his cyber plans. You have to address bipartisanship that he talks about a lot. The fact that it's certainly in the US, but in other countries too, you move from like one political extreme to another every 4 to 8 years, and then you undo the work of the, you know, and you also have to address
the
economic resistance to many of these plans. So you, I think that this is a really interesting start, but we need to, this is the beginning of a conversation, not the end.
Well, California certainly could lead some of this. I mean, if mm-hmm. you think about the brownouts that are going on right now there, if their energy was more secure.
Texas mm-hmm. too.
Yes. Oh, that's right. Texas is going.
Yes. Yep.
So anyway, so the idea that mm-hmm. think about where your voting blocks are. Mm-hmm. Think about who are the people who earn the economic engine that subsidizes the Mississippis of the world.
And those influential moments like the pandemic, like those brownouts, changing the viewpoint, changing the perspective for those people, maybe then we change policy as a result of seeing what is potentially a dangerous situation. Hopefully we'll get to more people understanding and less ignorance. Ignorance is bliss. Trust me. I'm the most ignorant person on the show, but it is also just, it's dangerous.
All right. So we're recording this on Juneteenth, mm-hmm. right? So Juneteenth took place in what city?
It wasn't Waco. It was one of the Texas cities. Tell me the city.
It was Galveston, Texas.
Okay.
So Galveston, Texas, it's not as big or as powerful as it once was. What happened to Galveston?
I don't know.
Hurricane came through, wiped it out.
Gotcha.
So that was the rise of Houston. What is Houston doing right now? They're putting up walls, trying to fight nature. That's what's going on. They're working on flooding issues. Mm-hmm. So Galveston had all the problems of New Orleans, and a hurricane came in and wiped it out. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we recognize that nature has a place in spite. You don't really fight that part of the of nature. My point being is that what we once took is, you know, this is the way it's going to be. Galveston's going to be this big city and stuff like that. No longer exists anymore on that same level. And so, you know, this is a shift, just a shift on how to deal with stuff.
It's interesting to think about what happens to an area after a pandemic, like a post-pandemic world. So that brings us, Pam, to our next book.
It does. I'm very excited about this one. This is a book written by Canadian Emily St. John Mandel. It's from 2014. And this is a book that I really enjoy teaching. It's called Station 11. And I've taught it many times before the pandemic. And this is a post-pandemic book. So it's really, I really am excited to talk to you guys about what it feels like to read it after, obviously, a very different kind of pandemic. We didn't wipe out 99% of the population, but nonetheless, you know, a very traumatic time that we've had these past 15 or 16 months. So yes, Emily St. John Mandel, Station 11 is my next pick for the book group.
This is exciting.
Our assignment for next week is parts 1 and 2, chapters 1 through 12, pages 1 through 67 for next week. Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. I look forward to this one.
Is she a saint?
Do you know anything about this one,
Chip? I have no idea.
Excellent. Excellent.
I have no idea, but I'm looking forward to reading this. What can you say? We're all having a lot of fun.
I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
What do you think, Pam?
Absolutely. I'm excited. This has been really fun.
Excellent. We would love to hear from you. What are you thinking? How are you making those incremental changes? Are those incremental changes getting us to 2050 or are we getting only to 2030? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Send us an email, sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. Our website is sandwiches@irregularhours.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Fedora.
We'll see you in the future. What I want to talk about, what I want to think for, what I want to think.